Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your social media feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the novel Brotherless Night.
And I'm Whitney Terrell, author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
So, Whit, if you could have a redo, what would it be?
You mean of a redo of what? Of like world history?
Just or world events. Anything. Okay.
I would say, all right, I wish the United States had never invaded Iraq. You know, I mean, that's a totally unnecessary event and a huge unforced error. And in my view, criminal error by us. Nobody involved in the 9/11 attacks was there. It's easy to see the ripple effects of that mistake, I think. A loss of faith in institutions, despair among the families who sent their sons and daughters there, in many cases lost them for no really good discernible reason, the death and displacement of many Iraqis, so many Iraqis. It's not hard to see how that general malaise leads to leaders like Trump in America who are offering simple solutions for what went wrong and not making people ask about like these more complicated mistakes. What about you? Do you imagine a Sri Lanka that didn't have a civil war?
I think on some days that's actually the only thing I imagine. Literature is particularly good at imagining and sketching out those alternative timelines and histories. And you know, I'm thinking of books like Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad, which I love, Michael Chabon's The Irish Policeman's Union, or our friend Fong Nguyen's novel Pages from the Textbook of Alternate History.
Definitely. I can think of lots of other examples as well. I mean, like, these alternate histories tend to crop up around historical moments that are so terrible, right? I mean, slavery, that's the one redo that I think at least every good American should want to change. The Iraq War, the Holocaust. These events are so terrible that they demand a sort of counter narrative. The question is, what do these narratives do? Why do, you know, imagining some different outcome, what role do they play in our lives? And fortunately today, we're joined by Ed Park, who has a brilliant new book out that reimagines the partition of Korea, among other things. And he's going to talk to us about the role of our alternative histories in our imagination and in our politics.
Ed Park is the author of the novels Same Bed, Different Dreams, which came out last year, named a top 10 book of the year by Publishers Weekly and a New York Times notable book, as well as Personal Days, which was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award. His fiction, essays, and reviews have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, Harper's, The Atlantic, Bookform, and many other publications. He is a founding editor of The Believer and the former literary editor of The Village Voice, and has worked in book publishing and academia. Born in Buffalo, Ed lives in Manhattan with his family. He currently teaches writing at Princeton. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
We really appreciate your joining us. So, Same Bed, Different Dreams begins in a speculative future in which a writer ends up reading a manuscript by another who is an older man known as Echo. And that manuscript is an alternative history of Korea that is kind of an interesting echo. And that manuscript itself appears within your book. And that manuscript is called Same Bed, Different Dreams, Being a True Account of the Korean Provisional Government. And since today we're talking about alternative histories, we're going to focus first on this part of your book. So, of course, that true account is true and also not. And as one of your characters notes, Americans sometimes know almost nothing about Korea, despite U.S. involvement with important parts of Korean history. So I thought that for the benefit of our listeners, we would just start with some basic events. So you write about and reference the Japanese occupation of Korea between 1910 and 1945, Korean resistance to that occupation in the form of the Korean Provisional Government. We'll come back to that. The post-World War II division of Korea into the North, administered by the Soviet Union, and the South, administered by the U.S., the North and South becoming sovereign nations in 1948, and the Korean War, which lasted from 1950 to 1953, and goes past that into there are other incidents as well. Did I get all of that right? And why did you decide to start with the period right before the occupation and kind of the rest of the colonial era?
I felt like at a certain point, I'd started writing the novel and the narrator, one of the narrators was Korean-American, had some of my biographical background. And you know, I'm essentially a comic novelist, or at least I think of myself as one. But then as I wrote, I realized I was getting into something that's both very important to me and something that didn't appear at all in Personal Days. So Personal Days was kind of a dark office comedy. There was basically no, there's a very small reference to ethnicity at like 2 points in the book. And part of that was because I had a very clear idea what that book was going to be. It was going to be about the office, and I almost like streamlined it to kind of focus on the comic aspects. And with Same Bed, which took about 9 years to write, just the fact that this was a kind of an Ed Park-like narrator, like that should have made it easy for me in some ways. But then I realized like people don't really know about the history of modern Korea. Like people will have heard of the Korean War, but I bet you most people don't know, most Americans don't know when that was. It's called the Forgotten War. You know, it's commonly labeled that here. And also like, why should they? Like, I feel like even I, as somebody who, you know, my parents came from Korea in the late 60s, I was born in Buffalo. It's not like, it's hard to get that information. You can say the education system should be better or whatever, but it's a very complicated history. So I think what I wanted to do was, you know, I'm interested in lots of, periods of Korean history, but you know, I didn't want to do like a Charlie Kaufman adaptation and start at the, you know, the beginning of all Korean history. But I thought like giving a clear sense of, Korea before it became a colony and leading up to, the Korean War. And then of course it extends beyond by a couple decades. This is mainly also because I realized that it would place, that narrator and some of the other characters, more firmly in the reader's mind in a historical sense. Like, what are they, how is it that there are Korean people in America? How is it that, you know, this narrator, Soon Shin, was like, what's he doing in Buffalo? And this is something, you know, as a kid, sometimes I would think like, what am I doing? Like, why am I here? I mean, I love Buffalo in many ways, but it's sort of, you look, especially in the 70s and 80s, there are, you know, you kind of stand out and you think like every other generation in my family was in Korea, speaking Korean. And here I am, like, I'm speaking English and I barely, you know, I understand some Korean, but it's fading, right? And so I thought, I'll say one more thing, which is that a lot of what I know about Korea that isn't through books and through pop culture, you know, comes from my parents, obviously. And my dad would, you know, tell me about his early life. He's old enough that he, you know, when he first went to school, it was to these, he had to learn Japanese, like the school was conducted in Japanese. He's old enough that he knew the chaos post-World War II leading up to the Korean War. And he's old enough to have, you know, been in kind of these very harrowing moments during the Korean War. And so, you know, it's kind of like, it helped me understand the characters better and the situation and also my parents and myself, I suppose.
The Korean Provisional Government,
yes,
which we will call the KPG, yeah, for the rest of this interview. It's that just acronym notice for the listener. So the Korean Provisional Government began by resisting Japanese occupation, and a version of it plays a significant role in your book. Can you just talk to us about the actual KPG?
Yes, sure. So Japan, for various reasons, Japan wants Korea, and they annex it in 1905, and it becomes a full-fledged colony in 1910. 1919 is when the kind of the last real king of Korea dies, and there's going to be a kind of a mass display of mourning. But what happens instead is they Koreans organize all across the peninsula. Remember, it's not north and south yet, so it's all one country. And they have a form of, peaceful protest. And there's a Declaration of Independence. That's in March of 1919. Just a little bit after that, the Korean Provisional Government forms. The headquarters is in Shanghai, in China. So a lot of these members are in exile. They choose as their president a man named Syngman Rhee, who is already in the U.S. at this point. And he's mostly living in Hawaii, but he's kind of been all over. He went after one of the major historical figures in the book. So he's elected in exile, and they don't really have any power, right? It's a figurehead, quote unquote, government, and they just kind of want to publicize what's happening, and that Korea is its own, its own nation, its own people, and this is unjust and things like that. So I first read about them, it must have been in this modern Korean history class that I took in grad school. So this is like in the early mid 90s, and I got a lot out of that class, but somehow that idea fascinated me, and maybe the word provisional fascinated me. Like, it's just such a, that adjective is so, it's full of possibility. And as a fiction writer, I just thought it would be fun to play with. And it took me, 30 years to follow up. But my KPG does not, it's based in that original reality. But what I do in the book is imagine it, lasting beyond 1948, and also rounding up people who were not at all part of the KPG. So Syngman Rhee was definitely part of it, and some of the other figures, but a lot of them, even the Korean ones, I just shoehorned them in because, we can talk about that, but it was part of what, when I realized the KPG was going to be in this book, it gave me a tremendous amount of freedom and inspiration to talk about these different people who have fascinated me for a while.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
It's really amazing, this kind of expansive notion of the KPG, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. But first I wanted to ask you about, you include the Korean War, and as you noted, it goes, of course, a couple of decades beyond that. And then there's also things like a famous airliner crash, et cetera. And
yeah,
the Korean War, which involved American troops, is North Korea invading South Korea in 1950. And yes. It was supported by China and the Soviet Union. So this is like a Cold War framework, really, while the U.S. supported South Korea, including with troops. And just as like a tiny bit of additional context, right, like the Japanese annexation of Korea follows like the Russo-Japanese War. And then like,
yes,
they're basically, it's like, it's a colonial powers horse trading and being like, well, you guys can have the Philippines if we can have Korea, which I was like, is really appalling, of course. And so like this follows like in the wake of that history. Why was the Korean War something that you wanted to include? It's like a particular strand of the novel actually focuses on it.
Yeah. It's almost like I opened a can of worms or Pandora's box or something, because when I realized the scope, kind of to go back to your earlier question, why start with the colonial period and stuff like that? When I realized that actually the book would be about history, like history was not just in the background, but I was going to foreground it, especially in this book within a book, right? That's also called Same Bed, Different Dreams. It's like, I could not omit the Korean War, and I couldn't do like a half-assed, that's a swear word, maybe, a half-assed job. And so, it's harrowing stuff, and it's just a grueling war that, that is technically, those countries are, they're not formally at peace, right? There's still hostilities, threats. Well, it's mostly the North threatening the South, but it's an unresolved war. And I think I found that very haunting, kind of ambient haunting growing up. I will mention that originally, my mom was born in Seoul, but her family is actually from way up the very northern part of Korea. It's called Shinwiju. I think I mentioned it in the book. My dad's family, he kind of grew up in what is technically, at one point it was North Korea, but when he was born, it was just the middle of the country, near a town called Cholwon. But the village where he lives is now in the DMZ, where he was born and partly raised is now in the DMZ. So that idea, I think, of not being able to, like, your hometown doesn't exist. You can't go there. You really can't go home again. It doesn't exist. And that, I think, was, you know, when something haunts you like that as a writer, you're just trying to, like, think of the reasons behind it. And I think that's, in a very personal way, I think that's part of why the Korean War sequel. It's like I had to put the whole war in there to sort of scratch that itch.
Just as a little bit more context for our listeners who might not know this, and I will say that I learned this approximately yesterday, preparing for this interview. You referred to the fact that it's like there's no peace treaty, right? It's an armistice, and South Korea didn't sign it. The U.S. signed it, but like South Korea did not, and North Korea was basically, as far as I can tell, like, completely like all buildings of significance were like flattened during this war.
Yeah.
And it's really sort of like, at least Whitney, I don't know about you, but I think that like in my education, which was not, you know, particularly influenced by like having Korean parents at home, et cetera, like I feel like my education on the Korean War was like basically nothing.
Right.
My uncle fought in it. Yeah. So I heard maybe more about it, but he never talked about it at all, really. Other than to say that it was very cold.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the actual process of the war and a lot of the things that we learned here, I'm learning really in preparation and in reading the book, to be honest. I mean, Sugi's married to someone who's a Korean scholar, which was very helpful in the writing of our script last night. So anyway, you know, but that, you know, that to me was telling that even though I had a family member participating in that war, I didn't feel like I knew a lot of these things.
I've heard stories like that, since the book came out, but even before when people realized I was touching on that, just like people saying their father or uncle had fought, in the Korean War. And also from like Korean American friends that I've known who are like, oh, my granduncle was in the second KPG. And I was like, what's the second KPG? And that was something that was formed. It's not in the book, but apparently it's if all the members of the KPG were assassinated, then the second KPG would come up. So I'm finding out like history is not, I mean, it's still with us, right? I mean, people within living memory are connected to this stuff.
I mean, the partition of a country is such a massive event. And, you know, if I think about it as somebody who, you know, was born here in this country and has had family here for a long time, it's like somebody saying to me, well, okay, you can't go to California anymore. You will never go there again,
right?
You know, or you will never go to Florida. Although right now I don't want to go to Florida, right. But I mean, there are reasons that I might want to go there again someday. Sure. And it would be impossible to imagine. Like, it's very difficult, I think, to imagine the extent of that loss in a historical way, especially for the people who were living at that time. Anyway, we want to ask you to read from the book. The book within a book,
yes.
Right? As Sugi talked about, is divided into five dreams. And we wondered if you could just read to us from the first one.
Sure. So, I'll start from, it starts on page 45. And, as Sugi mentioned, the book within the book is also called Same Bed, Different Dreams. In this case, it has a comma after bed. And then the title of my book has no comma. And that was actually a very late realization. Like for a long time, the working title had a comma, my own book. And then once I took it out, I felt like I'd reached a new level somehow. So here's the beginning of the book within the book, Same Bed, Different Dreams. Dream one, 1905 to 1937. One, metamorphoses. Seojapil becomes Philip Jason. Lee Sung-man becomes Syngman Rhee. An Jung-gun becomes Thomas An. Lee Il becomes Earl Lee. Park Young-man becomes Youngman Park. Lee Myung-bok becomes King Ko-jong. Architect Kim Hye-kyung becomes poet Lee Sang. Kim Jung-sik becomes Kim So-ol. And Kim Song-ju becomes Kim Il-sung. These are some members of the Korean Provisional Government.
Okay, so unconventionally for us, I want to pause here because the sequence of names you've included here is kind of an interesting historical puzzle, as you alluded to a little bit before. You've begun with nationalists and reformers like Syngman Rhee, who you mentioned, who was in the KPG and went on to become the president of South Korea. But then at the end of the first paragraph, you've named King Kojong, who was not in the KPG and who actually imprisoned Syngman Rhee. And then Thomas An was killed before the KPG formed, which is something that you kind of address a little bit later. And then Yi Sang was a child, like maybe 9 or 10 years old during the actual formation of the KPG. And then there's a sort of way that, the book addresses this in certain ways later. But this history begins by grouping them together, which is like a really interesting move. So we'll come back to this, but I wanted to annotate this for our listeners. Ed, would you go on?
Of course. The KPG is established in 1919 in Shanghai, China. From its foreign headquarters, this government in exile works to free the Korean Peninsula from the crushing embrace of Japan, which took over the country in 1910. The body dissolves in the late 1940s, sometime between the end of World War II, when Japan's defeat by the Allies means a briefly liberated Korea, and the start of the Korean War. This is what the scholars say, anyway, that the KPG failed because it didn't stop the Americans and Soviets from drawing a line at the 30th parallel, staking out their new zones of power. Failed because its own violent infighting paved the way for the division of Korea into North and South. Most unforgivably, it failed to prevent the Korean War in 1950, a conflict that remains unresolved to this day. 2. The real cause. But the KPG lives on, working behind the scenes, laying the groundwork. As long as the country is split in two, its people divided, the Korean Provisional Government will be the sole sovereign body acting on behalf of all Koreans. When the two halves finally reunite, when that day comes, whatever the public explanation, it will have come about through the unstinting efforts of the KPG. 3. To our critics. Though the KPG is originally based in Shanghai, its members are spread across the globe. Syngman Rhee, in Hawaiian exile for decades, gets elected as the first president in absentia. It's said that the Korean Provisional Government is more a state of mind than an actual governing body, that the KPG is impotent, holding no official power, and that it has trouble reaching consensus on even the most basic matters, because its officers are spread across the globe. Indeed, some haven't attended a single meeting. That its proclamations have hurt the Korean cause over the years, that its members have shown a damning lack of unity by their constant backstabbing, that its main accomplishment is fundraising for an impossible dream, and what is there to show for all the money? There will be things to show soon. Do not despair. 4. Q&A. Q. But wait, Thomas An, mentioned above, was executed in 1910, nearly a decade before the founding of the KPG. How can he be a part of the organization? A. An and several other men and women who died before the group's formation are considered anticipatory members of the Korean Provisional Government. Keep in mind, some of its members are secret, as the Korean Provisional Government already functions as a secret society of sorts. Its secret members can be so sub rosa that the regular secret members are unaware of them. Sometimes even the secret members don't know their members. Incidentally, some of the secret members of the Korean Provisional Government aren't even Korean. Here's another question. What is history?
Thank you. Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back. That question, what is history, keeps coming up throughout the book. It's like a refrain. By the end of Dream 5, you're reading from Dream 1, Echo, the author has claimed not only many prominent Korean and Korean cultural and political figures as members of the KPG, whether they were or not, but also people like Ronald Reagan and Philip Roth and Jesus Christ and Marilyn Monroe. Why does this version of a so-called political organization look more like an open-ended utopian society or when in history, many of these people were compromised, failed, or in conflict with each other? I mean, what's the significance? How does that device work?
It's a good question. What is history is the first line of the book, and it's a question I thread through the book. And I think the book is my way of of answering that impossible question. And by including all these figures, you mentioned, you know, Marilyn Monroe is maybe my favorite because she, you know, she happened to do a USO show there shortly after getting married to Joe DiMaggio, and by all reports, like, enjoyed it. And so it's like, oh, she's in. Philip Roth, who knew the Korean American writer Richard E. Kim. Maybe he blurbed Kim's book. They knew each other, and so Roth is in. I mean, partly it's
how come Dennis Rodman didn't make it? I don't understand.
Dennis Rodman, that's a different dream. Okay. That would have broken the internet. And I think, you know, in a way, it's sort of, you know, like this is almost like my way of telling history, like, to people who don't know or might be curious, but also making it for myself. And for example, I mentioned there's a whole sequence with Jack London, and he's going to he's in Korea in like 1904 to report on the Russo-Japanese War, and that's something I read, like, I don't know, probably in the early 90s, and I was like so mad at his like depiction of you know, Koreans as being just these lazy, you know, they're just terrible. And I wrote it down, I put it in my commonplace book, and it's just been bugging me. But then I was like, that means something. I don't know, that like, as I kind of lived my life and trying to put together a portrait of Korea, it's important to see how something like Jack London's view of Koreans, or, you know, Ian Fleming in Goldfinger calls them like the most vicious race of people, just to put that all together. And in this way, maybe the KPG is, you know, it's long departed from the historical roots of that group, and it's like kind of this organization that's in my mind, like all the people I've encountered along the way.
It reminded me, and I don't know if you can tell me whether this was an influence or not, of Thomas Pynchon's novel, The Crying of Lot 49, where he talks about this this old postal group, Thurn and Taxis. And that is a real private postal distribution company, but it's brought into the future in a way as a conspiracy theory, in a way that sort of explains everything that's happening to the characters in the book. And there's a conspiracy element to the KPG, right? I mean, that, but it's also a way of creating an invisible organization that links together things that are true. I mean, so frequently in Pynchon novels, you know, you say, well, that couldn't possibly have happened. And then you look it up and you're like, that is true, right? And he's you know, and so kind of like you're talking about the Jack London and Marilyn Monroe, like connections to this history that would be unexpected. And then you the device of the KPG is a way to weave them into the story, I guess. That's totally true.
And you know, I love Pynchon, and I think that book especially, like, there's something about reading that and having that kind of the same reaction you had, like, what's real here, what's not. And people have told me who've read Same Bed, Different Dreams that, you know, some of them are like, I kind of have my computer browser open because I'm looking up stuff and looking, and some of the, you know, the wildest things, like, are actually true. I should also say there are things that are made up, and certain historical figures who I have, you know, meeting and being in scenes together, that's just, they probably did not meet, and I put that in there. But it's I wanted it to be flexible enough to kind of use both fact and fiction to tell the story.
So I mean, trying to imagine a resistance to the partition of Korea seems like a positive thing to me. And like we've been sort of like talking about the way that alternative histories can be used to imagine better outcomes. Or the possibility of better outcomes, but also they can be used to erase things and avoid, you know, rather than address historical crimes. And to me, the entire Make America Great Again movement is in essence a political effort to enforce an alternative view of history. One in which slavery and Jim Crow did not occur, or weren't that bad, where white people were never discriminated against anyone, or so on. What separates positive alternative histories from pernicious ones?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, obviously this is, you know, this is a work of fiction, and I wondered along the way, like, why, what is this for? You know, I want to tell a good story. I want to kind of mobilize these figures that have been in my mind for ages and kind of create this tapestry. I think the positive side of it is just to tell people in hopefully an entertaining way and not like an info dump way, something about what Korea is and what Korea was. You know, when I started writing this book, you know, there was K-pop, but it wasn't like BTS level. Like all this kind of new interest in, and I think this was accelerated during the pandemic, like K-dramas and K-pop, something I never would have imagined as a kind of a landlocked kid in the 70s and 80s that anybody would care anything about Korea. Anyone kind of outside of Korea would. And I wonder if, I don't know, I think I was kind of conscious of that and wondering, like, you know, maybe this is another story about Korea that is a little bit different from, you know, the airbrushed actors on, you know, name your favorite K-drama or, you know, your favorite K-pop combo. Not to diminish them, but it's like, what are the roots of their, you know, their prominence?
To me, I guess the difference between an alternative history like yours or the other ones we mentioned at the beginning of the show and what like Ron DeSantis is doing in Florida is that a positive alternative history is actually trying to teach people about real history, but using a way of getting us out of our rut of the way that we think about a place, right? By creating an alternative storyline. But it's not saying you can't learn this. It's saying, please learn more about this, right?
And that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
That are pernicious are the ones who say, you can't learn this. We're not allowing you to know this, right? That seems like a difference.
I think BTS, by the way, totally follows from the conversation we were just having. They're currently on hiatus for military service.
Exactly. Oh my God. So interesting. Like of all the people, you'd think they would get a break, right?
And they're like globally popular.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
But so you have in a thread of the book, which is called 2333, have this character, Parker Jotter, who fought in the Korean War. And after he returns home, becomes a specfic writer. How does his character fit into the way you imagine America's role during the Korean War and in the separation of Korea into North and South?
I think his kind of surprise career as a speculative fiction writer is maybe you know, unconsciously on his part, because he says it has nothing to do with his experience in Korea. But I wonder if it points to a sort of idea of an alternate history, an alternate future, or a kind of utopia. He's been shattered by the war, and his books, which are, you know, somewhat popular for a while, he's trying to like write a story that has nothing to do with any kind of any earthly reality. Something happens, you know, later on, you know, we see that that's not quite the case, but there's something about his insistence that it's you know, it's purely a product of his imagination, like he has escaped from history, that I think is significant. I would also say he's my, you know, he's one of my ways into talking about Buffalo. So I imagine him as running an appliance store in Buffalo. And, you know, it actually reminded me, I had a, you know, growing up, we had a next door neighbors, and I didn't know that the father, like I barely talked to the father, but I was quite close to one of the kids who was around my age. But I think when the father died, you know, I saw the obituary that he had, he had fought in Korea. He might have even had a Purple Heart. Like, it's just sort of this idea of, I'm not saying Parker Jodder is that neighbor, but just trying to imagine a little bit like what it would mean to like, you know, go through this kind of, you know, intense, terrible war experience and then come back to a place like Buffalo and try to put a life together that was close to normal. And, you know, he endures a lot, but, you know, there's something about him that, you know, as I wrote, he sort of became one of the main figures of the novel.
Well, he's also Black. And I think that, you know, he feels isolated within his, among the soldiers that he fights with, who are almost uniformly white. And I would think that his race would also play, play a role in the way that he thinks about the Korean War as well.
Yeah. And this was something, this was kind of a, I mean, you can imagine I was, you know, just reading about the Korean War and realizing that there were some Black fighter pilots. And I think put forth one solid reading, but the idea that he comes back and he's attacked, he is attacked in Buffalo, and that's connected to something I remember quite vividly for various reasons. But in 1980, there was a serial killer. He was called the 22 caliber killer, who preyed on black men and black boys. And there were also, anyway, there was a character who, there was a real life person who, some people who managed to get away, and I thought, maybe this is something that Parker Jodder experiences. I have to say also there was, I mean, this is just, I mean, it's an aside, but I wonder if, you know, as I was writing it, there was this, you know, horrible racist massacre in Buffalo.
Yeah. A supermarket. About that on the show.
Yeah, it's called, you know, it's a long-lived chain of supermarkets in Buffalo called Tops. And I realized I have these newspaper clippings about the 22 caliber killer, and his first victim was actually at a Tops, in the parking lot of a Tops. And it just seemed like it probably doesn't matter to most readers, but it felt like a significant detail, so I included it.
In a more positive light, speaking of Buffalo, before we go, do you follow your football team there?
I do follow my football team. There's a lot of the Sabres, the hockey team, in this book. There's one mention of the Bills in which they lose to the Chargers, and so a couple weeks ago, they just barely beat the Chargers in real life, maybe my next book will have more Bills material, but of course I'm hoping that they come through this weekend, and by the time people listen to this, they'll still be in it.
Well, I'm sitting in Kansas playoffs. City, so we are well aware of your team. Right, well,
yeah,
we're hoping to come and visit next weekend if we can get past
the
Dolphins.
We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. Yeah, no, it's football is sort of. I mean, speaking of my dad, it was, I have this clear memory of him teaching me all the names of the football teams, like when I was very little. And so he, you know, he's watching every game on TV, as everyone in Buffalo does. But, you know, it's not a casual thing with him or with me. So,
well, Ed, thank you so much. This has been really fun. And I think, you know, I learned so much from all of these references, and also appreciate the wit and humor and tenderness that knits all of them together. And listeners, I encourage you to go grab a copy of Same Bed, Different Dreams, no comma, and Ed's other work, available at an independent bookstore near you. Ed, thank you.
Thank you both so much. This is really great, and I love the questions. Thanks so much.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Anne Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel, and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!